You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing this evening? I have just gotten back from my first visit to the Green Music Center at Sonoma State University. What a remarkable place. I knew it would be, and I just hadn't had occasion to go. And then very dear friends of mine who have season tickets, I think it is, they asked us to go, me and Lucas, who has been a guest here several times. He is now 12 years old and quite the movie buff, as he has been since he was about four. And tonight's, this afternoon's show was the San Francisco Symphony doing movie music with Mark Hamill of Luke Skywalker fame. Narrating. So it was a very interesting premise, and it's a great performance. I have to apologize. The top of my head, I can't remember the name of the conductor. Her first name was Sarah. Her last name started with an H, but I can't remember it. She was magnificent. Really, really stunning to watch her conducting. Mesmerizing, actually. I could hardly take my eyes off her. But what a great place that is. And there's a restaurant, Prelude. It's actually just reviewed by Jeff Cox in the Press Democrat. We had lunch there. Much different experience than Jeff had, partly because when Jeff was there, everyone went for dinner immediately at the end of the concert. And so they went from an empty restaurant to a full restaurant in like 5 seconds. So service was, if you read Jeff's review, service was a little difficult. But we had a very leisurely, nice lunch, walked around. And then John Boland, my friend who took us, and John and Jim, he had gotten a phone call earlier asking if he would sound the gong that signals the start of the show. And they said, oh, Lucas will be thrilled. Yes, we will do it. And so we were escorted up to almost this catwalk that is right at the end of the building above where the doors open on the outside seating. And you can see the gong. It's a beautiful, huge, beautiful gong. You can see it from the outside seats. And you have to warm it up. So you have whatever it's called. It's not a drumstick. It's way bigger. You have to circle the gong with this 7 times and then smack it, and that gets it warm, and then you smack it and it just resounds. And Lucas got to do it and he was beaming and we got some great photographs. I haven't had a chance yet to read who else is appearing this season, but I know that early next season the incredible opera singer Jesse Norman is going to be there, and I hope I will be there as well. Anyway, the Green Music Center, check it out. Lots of things happening in Sonoma County right now. The Barlow is starting to show a little more action than usual. Businesses are starting to open. Wood 4 Brewery with food opened yesterday. I have not been there yet. I was at a party on Wednesday evening at Costa Brown Winery. It is a huge, huge and beautiful facility. They make a great Pinot Noir. Their Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir is outstanding. And then this evening is an opening party for Zazu Restaurant. If you've been wondering, hey, where's Zazu? They closed their Santa Rosa location on Guerneville Road, and they are reopening in the Barlow on Wednesday. So, like I said, a lot of changes and a lot of new things in Sonoma County. Check it out. Tonight, we have, I think, is what is going to be a very interesting show. We have with us Clark Smith, who does absolutely everything. He's a musician. He makes wine. He writes books. I have his book, Postmodern Winemaking, in my hand. He writes a column for, I think it's Wine and Vines.
Wines and Vines.
Wines and Vines.
Mm-hmm. Sing Barbershop at the Green Center.
And has more tricks than I could even name up his sleeve, I am sure. So right now, the studio is filled with wines. Playlists are floating about, as is music. Oh, he also does wine and music pairing, which is sort of a secret little passion of my own, as you know if you read my column, my wine pairing column on Wednesdays. Welcome to Mouthful.
Well, thank you, Michelle. It's so great to be here.
Let's start with your book. What does postmodern winemaking mean?
Well, I have to go a little bit of history.
Sure. As much as you want.
When I hit my junior year at MIT and they made me declare a major, and I couldn't figure out what I was doing there. So I wandered out to California, got a job in a liquor store, and started selling wine, Jackson's Wines and Spirits in Oakland.
Oh, in Oakland, okay.
And so we were the Library of Congress for American
wine. So you left MIT because you couldn't figure out what major to declare?
Yeah, okay. And I was trying to do something scientific and also sort of artsy at the same time, and I stumbled into the rapidly growing California wine industry, and that was where I found my bliss, I guess. I didn't realize it at the time, and I don't think most people are aware of it, but California winemakers, almost none of them knew anything about making table wine in 1970. We'd only been making table wine for about 5 years.
What did they know? Instead of making table wine, what
Port
did they
and
know?
Sherry.
Okay.
And when you put that 20% alcohol in a wine, it has no microbiology, so you didn't have to know anything. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that the beautiful off-dry wines that we drink, you know, Rieslings and White Zinfandels and Gewürztraminers and stuff, those don't exist in nature. You can't make wine like that without atomic energy. We only started making off-dry white wines. The wines, you know, everything started with Blue Nun, and that was because we had these special filters that we made in atomic piles that allowed us to...
Wait a minute here. Slow down. What's an atomic pile?
Nuclear reactor. To bottle sweet wine and not have it explode, you have to put it through a filter that you can test to make sure that it doesn't pass yeast.
And the
original ones were made in nuclear reactors. We'd put sheets of plastic in and etch them. So anyway, this all hit the ground about 1965.
Now, but the first question that comes to mind is, mm-hmm. why did we want off-dry wines?
Oh, everybody wants sweet wine. They really do. The only reason champagne ever came into existence was to make sweet wine.
Really?
All champagnes were at least 6% sugar until the crazy British came along, and then the French wouldn't even give them French names. They called them extra dry and then brut, which means only an animal would drink it. And then you have port and sherry, and then you have Botrytis wines. And outside of that, you just... None of the wines that we think of today, and practically all the Chardonnay we make is sweet.
And there's a reason I don't like Chardonnay.
Well, I don't blame you. I have one you'll like tonight, though. But I'm very interested in what those wines were like for the first 8,000 years before World War II and atomic energy and the emergence of modern white wine.
So you're saying that previous to that time, white wines were typically off-dry or a bit
no,
sweet?
No, they were dry.
Oh, they were dry before then. Then we started making them sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. Without
in the United States.
Without these, what we call bubble pointable, integrity testable filters. No, not just the United States, everywhere.
Oh.
It was technically impossible to bottle an off-dry wine, like a German Riesling. Those were all invented in the 60s. Peter Shishel invented Blue Nun, and without Blue Nun and that whole stainless steel and inert gas, all that modern winemaking stuff, you don't get New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. It's all the same method, and it was all invented in the 60s. So my point is, okay, I dropped in about 5 years after that technology existed, and then I just sold wine in a wine shop for about 6 years. So I got to know my Burgundies and Bordeaux, and there were only about 250 wineries in the United States. So now there's 8,000. See, at that
remarkable,
time...
remarkable, isn't it?
Well, and what it means is that at that time, we had every single wine made in the United States on our shelves. And people think you can buy wine in a store now, but the truth is there's just domestic wines. There's over 100,000 wines now, which means that very same store would only have 1% of what there is. And, of course, it's all corporate now. So, you know, Mondavi and Kendall Jackson, and those are the kinds of wines
Gallo
that you buy in stores. Yeah, sure. So 98% of labels, you have to go to the winery. Almost all wine. I'm not talking about the volumes. I'm just talking about the number of products. Mm-hmm. Almost all wine is sold direct.
Mm-hmm.
And our system isn't very good for doing it. You just have to get in your Prius and go.
Okay, yes. Get in your Prius and go get some postmodern wine. Is that it?
So, yeah. I think... I would not disparage the wonderful achievements of modern science around winemaking, but they've done a couple of things. One is, what if every time you learn something, you have to forget something? So what did we lose track of? And I think one thing is we sort of lost track of the aesthetic of it. We lost track of grace and beauty and substituted impact. It's just like what's happened in the movies, where, you know, the movies used to be about dramas and foreign films and the odd comedy, and now it's really pretty much blowing things up.
And there's the reason I don't go to many movies.
Yeah, there you go. And I think this is...
You're describing a modern world that I don't love.
Well, I think it's very important for consumers to just look at, make the same decision when they buy a bottle of wine that they make when they go to the movies, which is, what are we going to be doing tonight? Is it a comedy? Is it something to make us smile? Is it going to be an impact, you know, wine that'll slap us around a little bit? Or do we want a wine that'll make us scratch our head, something that we've never seen before? Dramas and foreign films. Those are the kind of wines I like to make.
Mm-hmm.
And people taste them and they go, huh. And so they don't go, wow. And they don't go, oh, that's yummy.
They go, huh. Which is, that's often a very good reaction. So, you know, you're a winemaker for Diamond Ridge?
We're actually changing our name. It's Two Jakes of Diamonds now. Because Jake wanted to put his dad.
Jake of Diamond?
Jake Stevens and his father.
Okay, so
Two Jakes of Diamonds.
Okay, and then you also make wine for your own label.
Winesmith, and then my cheaper wines are called Penny Farthing.
Penny Farthing, okay.
And then I have a brand called Planet Pluto that's crazy wines from all over, from places you never heard of.
Like what? Let's start with Planet Pluto.
Okay. It's a Meritage, and it's from Sassoon, the Hames Valley, Mendocino, places like that. You know, Sassoon is the part of the Napa Valley that got disqualified about
Sassoon.
25.
I know Sassoon really well.
They're absolutely wonderful wines. And when you go over the Solano County line, the grapes go from $4,500 a ton to $700 a ton.
Yeah.
And they're actually better.
Yeah, so, I don't know anything about Sassoon grapes. I just know the town.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, they're terrific.
I have friends who live there.
Certainly some of the best Petit Sirah and some of the best Sauvignon Blanc in the country. Oh yeah. And they're cheap. I mean, they're 5 minutes off the freeway and nobody knows
they're there. They're right there. Yeah. South of Fairfield.
So I work with a guy named Gary Mangles there, and he gives me Cabernet and Merlot and, you know, lots of places like that. People don't realize that when you buy Napa, you're really buying an insurance policy that doesn't pay off. You're really not buying wine.
You're buying a name.
You're buying some assurance. And, you know, we look for lots of assurances in the wine industry because kind of getting back to the way it was in the 70s, it was very, very open. Everybody was talking to each other. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody knew how to make table wine, and so we were all exchanging information quite a bit. And then a couple things happened. The wine technology got weirder and weirder till it got to the point that the winemakers really don't know how to explain it. And, you know, the trouble is consumers, they can kind of smell it when you're not being straight with them.
Now, when you say it got so complicated they didn't know how to explain it, let's do winemaking 101, like the 30-second version.
Okay.
You pick the grapes at the amount of sugar you want it.
Well, hopefully not.
Well,
sugar doesn't have anything to do with ripeness, but
you pick the grapes when
flavor,
you
flavor, color,
you, yeah, when you
acidity,
want how when you like how they taste,
when you like how they taste, when you consider them ripe,
and then you either destem them or press them on the stem, depending on what the varietal is, and then you ferment it.
Right. I mean, generally, I think white wines are usually made from white grapes, but we can make white wine from red grapes.
But
if we just take the skins away right away.
Right, but basically, you get some grapes picked at the right time.
Yeah.
You ferment them. You drain them off, all the seeds and stems and all that, and you let it sit around either in barrels or stainless steel for a while, then you put it in a bottle. Yeast is involved in the fermentation process. There's winemaking 101.
Okay.
What are the steps that are making it so mysterious and hard to explain? What's being introduced along the line there?
Well, you mentioned picking on sugar.
Shorthand, we don't have to stay there.
No, but it's very important.
I think it was an inaccurate depiction.
But it's important because the sugar determines how much alcohol the wine has.
Right, yes.
So in France, it's very rainy and cold. And so they often don't get enough sugar. And so this guy named Chaptal, who worked for Napoleon, came up with the idea, well, let's just put some beet sugar in there. And so we correct the sugar. And that's kind of easy to understand. People sort of wish we didn't have to do it, but there it is. In California, it's so dry that when we get the proper ripeness, flavor, color, tannin that we're looking for, we have way too much sugar, way too much alcohol. So I developed a method, and then there's some others. I use a water purification filter, a reverse osmosis filter, to take some of the alcohol out so that we can make sort of normal, balanced wines. Mm-hmm. Kind of going from the other direction, but trying to do the same thing that they've been doing in France for 200 years to correct the balance.
Yeah, so in a way, you're sort of spinning off some of the alcohol.
Well,
there's a thing called
the spinning cone. That's one of the other technologies.
Okay.
Yeah. And how do you explain that to people? They really want wine to be the one true untouched thing. But I don't know. I feel like top chefs do a lot of high-tech things, liquid nitrogen. I think it's actually a very interesting thing to do to take soft cheeses and be able to grate them by freezing them with liquid nitrogen. It's kind of an interesting idea.
And then there's, don't even get me started on that stuff.
Sous vide, that's a wonderful
sous vide
way to cook.
Using seaweed to make pearls of peach flavor and, we're talking micro-gastronomy now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But the neat thing about chefs is that they've been able to explain it. And so people think you may or may not go for one or the other, but mostly you just want good food.
Mm-hmm.
And you want it to be made by honest people that are being straight with you about what they're doing. And that's what I want to get back to in the wine industry. Because I think now many consumers are distrustful of winemakers because, candor, they're really not being straight. And so they're taking advice from people that kind of don't know what they're talking about. So the purpose of the book largely was to explain what we're really doing.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we're really moving into an inquiry about what did we lose when we got scientific? How do we get the aesthetic back? How do we make wine that's soulful, not just clean, but wine that moves us.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Franklin called wine proof that God loves us and desires us to be happy. And Robert Louis Stevenson talked about bottled poetry. I think I'm going to show you some bottled poetry.
Okay,
tonight.
Let's do it. Actually, why don't we put in a song so you can get your bottles over here and stuff? Do you need a little bit of time?
A little bit, I suppose.
Okay, we're just going to play a little snippet of a song because one of the other things that we'll probably get to is the idea of music and wine pairing. And so I've chosen the first song that to me is always about Pinot Noir.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying me down in silence, easy to be born again, to be born again? From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me and push another door. Could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes, lay me down in silence, easy to be born again, to be born again? There you go, standing with the look of avarice, talking to Hugo Ledbetter, showing pictures on the wall, whispering in the hall. I'm pointing a finger at me. There you go, there you go, standing in the sun, darling, with your arms behind you and your eyes before. And there you go, taking care of your boy, seeing that he's got clean clothes, putting on his little red shoes, seeing that he's got clean clothes, putting on his little red shoes, pointing a finger at me.
Yes, Van Morrison's classic Astral Weeks. Absolutely Pinot Noir. Would you agree or disagree?
I liked it. We have some Pinot here, and I tasted it. I thought it made it extremely spicy. We've got some particular clone 667 in there that has a spicy element to it, and it really brings it out.
So you thought the music brought out the spicy element?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But it didn't make it harsh.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, so how are we going to taste?
Well, you know, I'm going to slightly abandon my plan because I really want to show you my credentials.
Okay.
And we were talking about what postmodernism is in words. I'm going to show you in a wine.
Okay.
So this is my $100 Cabernet. This is Crucible, and it's a single vineyard Cabernet from Napa made in a French style. So here I'm looking for balance and grace, and really what I think the Napa Valley can do better than almost no place on earth, and almost never does anymore.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You definitely hit it when it comes to grace.
Thank you.
It's definitely a very graceful wine. It's not a fruit bomb. You know, it doesn't smack you in the head the second it goes into goes onto your palate. It's got more mid-palate and back-palate flavors than it does front-palate flavors.
Right.
And the tannins are very smooth, you know, very long and smooth. And then there's a long black licorice, cocoa, and a little bit of sort of a cross between that forest floor quality and cigar on the finish.
Yeah. And I think it's built to age. You know, this is this is intended.
What
to
year
be
is
a,
this?
This is '04.
Okay. It doesn't. It does not taste like a super young wine.
Wine is a little like baseball. That if you want it to taste wonderful the minute it's bottled, then you're kind of hitting a pop fly, and it's going to come down in the infield. And if you really want to make a wine that will age, it's going to take a while for it to open up. Yeah. It's still going to be rising when it leaves the infield if you want to swing for the fences.
Now, since you've been paying attention to the California wine industry for a long time, let me tell you one of the things I noticed. And I didn't have my eye on the industry. I was paying a little bit of attention, mostly just for personal pleasure and learning what I liked because I was new. I was young. It seemed to me sometime in the very early 80s, things changed when it came to red wine. And what it's from my outsider perspective, it seemed to me that a lot of doctors who had invested in wineries, two things were happening. They'd invested too much money, so they were releasing their wines too soon.
Yes.
And they were all playing my cab's bigger than your cab against
each
other.
That's right.
Am I right?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
It
okay,
actually
that's
has
my
to
instincts.
Do with, everybody knows about bottle shock and the judgment in Paris in
1976. Yes.
We came back from that and we said, how on earth could we possibly have beat the French? And in all candor, the wines weren't really that terrific. But what they did have going for them was size. You know, in France, where they plant everything on the northern edge of ripeness, a big Chardonnay is very rare. And so when the French saw those big Chardonnays, they thought, well, this must be Montrachet.
And it was Chateau Montelena.
Yes.
That both Chardonnay.
Although it was a Sonoma wine. Most people don't know that. But anyway, it was a big wine. And we can make big wine here. Before 1976, we were trying to make Rhine wine and Chablis and, you know, light, delicate 11% alcohol whites that were imitating the Europeans. After that, it became sort of a big breasts contest. Just as you say, my wine's bigger than your wine. A lot of the investment was people that just wanted to show off. And I think it's a little bit like what happened with coffee. When we first got away from MJB and Folgers, everybody wanted to taste the heavy
dark French roast because the only way
they could judge quality was impact.
Yeah.
And then later on, some of them said, well, I'd actually like to enjoy my coffee. Mm-hmm. And so we came back the other way. And that's postmodern coffee making right there. So
now I'm curious what where you cite a change away from that mine's bigger than yours attitude. I know where I place it, but I'm not going to say yet because I want to know. Where did you see that start to change in California?
Well, I'm not really sure I have seen it change.
Oh, really?
In Napa, the average for the cult Cabernets is still 17% alcohol.
Yeah.
I think 2010 and 2011 were very useful years because they were so cold that unless you added high proof, and a lot of people did, you couldn't get those kind of alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
And then people said, well, these wines have acidity and fruit, and they're really rather good. I can tell you from a technical point of view when we got the tools to do it. What happened was, first of all, the Germans really won World War II in the wine business because they developed this way of making white wine, and then they convinced the French that they should be making Cabernet the same way we make Riesling. So they got the stainless steel and the inert gas, and they said oxygen is the enemy of wine, and they started making wines that had no refinement. What we now know is that the Aztecs taught the Belgians how to take cocoa powder and turn it into chocolate using oxygen. Those waterfalls in Willy Wonka, the chocolate waterfalls, they really have those. Mm-hmm. That's called conching. And we lost the skill of that when we went to stainless steel. And so we went through the 61s and even the 70s were not very good wines. They were modern, technically made wines, Cabernets being made like Riesling. And so they were just harsh. And so to get away from that, we started in the 70s, we pressed them sweeter. And then finally the Australians came in. There was this flying winemaker thing in the 80s where they figured out that if they got the grapes riper, that they wouldn't have that harshness and they would also be fruitier and they would come roaring right out of the bottle. But the reserve wines, just started falling apart. And so there was this guy, Patrick Ducournau, in the late 80s. He was a peasant vigneron in Matteron making Tannat, which is an amazingly tannic grape. Mm-hmm. And his neighbors were just pulling it out and putting in Merlot. And he said, no, we have to protect our tradition, but somehow we have to deal with this tannin. And he, kind of in a dream, figured out that chocolate making was what they needed to learn how to do. And he developed a procedure which they call it conching in chocolate. Mm-hmm. We call it micro-oxygenation. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once you make dark chocolate, Nestle figured out to put milk protein to make milk chocolate, mm-hmm. which is softer still. And so he figured out you could use yeast lees for that. And he developed this whole set of principles called élevage. I was going to sort of toss this in when you were given your 30-second version of winemaking, that really what we've learned, and I think you said it just right, that's modern winemaking says that you ferment it and then you wait around for it to clarify and you put it in the bottle. Mm-hmm. But what Ducournau figured out is that these élevage, it's the name for raising horses or raising children, that you really need to work with the wine after fermentation to refine its tannins and make it into something soulful that integrates flavors together.
And it does that through micro-oxygenation?
Well, it's one of the tools.
Uh-huh.
But you have to understand vine balance and proper ripeness, mm-hmm. and extraction. And there's a whole series of steps on just good cooking.
Okay.
I mean, the real postmodern idea is that winemaking is not a science project. It's not about knowledge. It's about making something delicious that mm-hmm. moves people. It's really, there's science in service to art.
Let's try something else.
Okay. Well, you want to do a little wine and music experiment?
Sure.
Now, I was saying wine is like the movies, and I've got three different Chardonnays here. This first one is the largest selling Chardonnay in the world. It's Glenallan, and it's a comedy. So here, have a taste. Sort of a Macon style, doesn't have very much oak, has a little bit of sugar, and it's covering up an astringency, because when you make, you know, $5 Chardonnay, you have to press it pretty hard, and if you just wait a second after you swallow it and the sugar's gone, you'll see that there is a pithy hardness, sort of like when you try to get your last nickel's worth out of a tea bag and you wrap the string around the spoon and you mash
squeeze.
It. Yeah, you
and
get that pithy tannin. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely got that forward sweetness.
Mm. Yeah, so it's very fruity, and it's a kind of a cheerful wine. Wouldn't change your life.
No.
Okay, so I'm going to call that the yummy style.
Okay.
Okay? And its whole purpose, just like a screwball comedy film, is to make you smile. Oh, I can see it's not doing that because it's not your style. But
not my style.
Okay, but we're going to play with this.
That's the kind of wine that if it was the only thing available, I'd look around for an ice cube.
Well, my goal here is to teach your listeners how to get the most out of every bottle of wine they buy from here on in.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to play music that is going to make me respond to that wine better?
I am.
Okay.
Okay, now here is the classic. This is a Carmenet 2011, and this is your classic California Oaky Toasty Butter Bomb with a little too much alcohol and very little recognizable Chardonnay aroma, but it has all of the classic, it's what we call a big fat mama.
Yep, definitely.
Okay, and it has a different kind of astringency that comes from oak. We call it parching numbing, and it's sort of on the front part of the tongue. It's very, very drying.
Yeah.
But it has a numb.
Puckery. It's a puckery thing.
It's a numb donut. Right in the middle, there's nothing.
Right.
That's because eugenol is an anesthetic. So oak actually deadens your tongue. Okay? And then the third one is my wine. This is that was an action adventure wine.
Action adventure.
Oh, don't
okay.
throw them away.
Oops.
We're going to be playing.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I saw you dumping, so I thought I was supposed to.
Well, I just. All right, and then this is Faux Chablis. It's a Chardonnay from Napa Valley College, and it's made in a minerally style. No malolactic, so it doesn't have butter, and
nice.
No toasted oak.
Okay.
I stir lees mm-hmm. to
say what that means.
Give it some fatness. The lees, the yeast.
Yes, you stir it. Right, the lees light, that settled
just
on the
stir
bottom.
Stir them, and this is really the same thing as adding milk, the milk protein to milk chocolate. So we're making the tannins coated and plump. But the most important thing here is, even though we're not on limestone like they are in Chablis, where they get this very minerally sort of buzz in the finish, this wine has it. It's a sandy loam, but we use organic principles in that vineyard. Lots of weeds. Where,
and where's the vineyard?
It's Napa Valley College, so it's just down south of Napa Town. And you'll see quite a bit of energy in the finish. So that's for seafood. It's not fat. It's a kind of a, you know, it's a wine that makes you scratch your head a little bit. Dramas and foreign films.
Yeah, you don't immediately say yuck, which I do with most Chardonnays. This does not have that. It doesn't have any of those forward unpleasant qualities I find in a Chardonnay.
You might see some lemon oil in the nose and a little of a sort of champagne kind of smell from the yeast.
Is that mineral quality that I happen to like, the mineral elements.
Not everybody does, but I'm sort of in love with those. So
I like this. That sort of like very, very cold water splashing over river rocks, that or licking wet cement. Which, take your pick.
Well, I think it's almost like licking a battery, except it's in your throat. This wine... I've lost the thread. Well, never mind. Let's just
oh, wait,
play
what,
with these.
What, but movies.
Oh, dramas and foreign films.
Okay. So we have comedy, action and adventure, drama and foreign film.
Or you could say the yummy style, the wow style, and the style.
I'm gonna come up with my own terms for those and see what you think.
That's excellent. But I think it's good for people. Every wine that anybody ever makes is one of those three styles, just like movies. Mm-hmm. And it's good for a consumer to realize what the winemaker is trying to do. Mm-hmm. So now I'm gonna see if we can change all that.
Okay.
We're going to repeat an experiment that we did back in 1996 for a bunch of winemakers. And I got to get my iPod going here.
It's the first time we'll have used an iPod on Mouthful.
Oh, I feel so honored, except the thing isn't turning on. Ah.
Is it being bad?
It's being bad. It was working just a minute ago.
Yeah, I can attest to that. Do you need to restart?
We may have to. Why don't we chat about postmodern winemaking?
Well,
and I'll go with Plan B here.
Okay. Sure.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch and the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying you down in silence, easy to be born again? To be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me, and I'm pushing out the door. Could you find me? Would you kiss on my eyes, lay me down in silence, easy to be born again.
Okay, I think that we have the experiment ready to go. Is that right, Craig? Almost. He's looking at the equipment. The suspense builds. Speaking of suspense, that was a highlight for me today at the Green Music Center was when they did Psycho. Just love that music. Let me see.
That's it. Okay, good.
That's Michelle it. Saves the day.
She does. All right, you ready?
Yes.
Now, I just want you to taste these wines again and just pay attention to the balance and the strength.
You want me to taste them now?
Yeah.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
How do you see how the tannin here becomes unbearable? Where here, that pithy tannin that was so disagreeable kind of melts into the music.
And what happens with the third one?
Well, I can't say this music does that wine any favors.
Okay.
But let's just change the environment.
Okay. So we should say that, maybe pull the sound down just a little bit. We should say that the California Girls makes the Glen Ellen Chardonnay smoother.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
I'll go along with that.
Okay. So now let's put something that's a little bit more in the emotional modality of that second wine, and this is Ella Fitzgerald doing St. Louis Woman.
Clark, maybe have your volume just a little bit lower. The volume on the player.
So now that butter and that heat from the alcohol in the second one just kind of melts into this bluesy thing.
Yeah, you actually really don't notice it quite as much, though I have to say the bitter aftertaste is still there.
But more pineapple in the nose. And now try the Glen Ellen. Now it's just completely dreadful. Amps up that tannin.
It amps up the sugar, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes the wine kind of fall apart. My wine's going to be a little better here. Blues is kind of good for this style. But what I really like with that kind of wine is modern jazz. So here's this is J.Ru. It's a Chet Baker, Jerry Mulligan piece. And that's what I like with those Chablis-style wines. Really let you get through to the depth of the flavor. By the way, these two wines are 2011s. My wine is a 2003.
Wow.
And it's still green.
Yeah, it's really a lovely Chardonnay. It really is. Yeah. I don't know if I can say that it made a difference with the Chet Baker song. But it might just be that I need more time to respond to the jazz.
Well, it's true, and it is a thoughty wine. It's true. If we have a minute here, I'll show you some quick things with Chardonnay and Cabernet. I've got, Pinot. And so this is my Cab. You had that before, and so that's Crucible. And this is a Pinot I made from Fiddlesticks Vineyard down in the Santa Rita Hills. And I wanted to make, again, something that didn't have so much hang time. Mm-hmm. You know, the movie Sideways has been really bad for Pinot. And I wanted to make a Pinot that wasn't trying to be an impact wine, something with some real
grace.
I
specifically did not see that movie. I didn't want it.
It really was bad for the industry.
I didn't want it to influence anything about my perception of Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
As I was writing about Pinot Noirs long before it got noticed, just because I sort of stumbled on it as the wine I liked. Okay. Oh, Santa Rita Hills is, you know, which is a great region for Pinot Noir.
So see what you make of that. And then we'll try some of my...
Oh, no.
Pinot selections. And she's screaming in terror because I've put Sutter Home White Zinfandel here on the table. And and I claim that I'm going to come up with a piece of music that I'm not sure will make you love Sutter Home White Zinfandel, but it'll certainly make it the best wine on the table.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what am I tasting first?
Okay, but let's just you've already had the Cabernet, so mm-hmm. try this nice Pinot. And I think you'll see very silky. It's a 2005. It's nowhere near ready to drink, but it does show off the kind of hibiscus flower and cherry characteristics of that region, as opposed to the big dry tannins and mm-hmm. bitterness and raisin character that you often see.
Smooth. It's got a silky quality, but with the tannins are still a little bit fuzzy mm-hmm. in the back.
Right. Right, it's still dense.
Yeah,
it needs time.
Definitely needs
mm-hmm.
some time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then here's this lovely white Zinfandel.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What I do for work.
You
huh?
are a terrible snob. I hate to tell you, in a lot of restaurants, it's sometimes the best wine you can order. at least it's consistent.
My problem is I've never had much of a sweet tooth. I don't care much for anything
sweet.
Me
neither. Okay, so now, would you say that I have these wines from left to right in order of increasing tannin and astringency?
Yeah, okay. I can say that.
Now, let me see if I can reverse the order.
Okay.
I'm going to see if I can make this the smoothest and this the harshest.
Okay, take a
shot. Being in the middle. Now, the way you do it is you have to conceive of what is the emotional modality of that wine. And for me, Cabernets tend to be sort of dark and even angry. And so let's try this.
And what am I supposed to try?
Just taste all
things. Oh, taste all things. Okay.
Faces look ugly when you're alone.
So this kind of sinister piece is a terrible match for this sort of cheerful, this is kind of a major key wine.
Actually, it makes it better.
It makes it drier, that's true.
It makes it drier.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're actually taking advantage of the harshness. Yeah.
It makes the Pinot unpleasant.
It just completely takes away that silkiness.
It flattens it and makes it,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pinots don't like cinnamon. When you're a stranger, faces look ugly. When you're alone,
women seem wicked. When you're unwanted, streets are unwanted. That seems more tannic.
When you're down. Do you think so?
Yeah.
Well.
But it could be because I didn't rinse between. Let me try it again.
What you mean. Yeah.
Let me try it again.
I mean, there is a framing to it, but I get a lot of sweet fruit in the middle.
I just don't.
Okay. Okay, now let's do a Pinot piece.
Okay.
This is Greensleeves, and I love your playlists. This is a Laura Sullivan Greensleeves, and this will have the opposite effect. I mean, if you thought that was tannic a second ago, it is. You know what I love about this kind of experiment is, first of all, there's no right answers, but it's something that's kind of cutting edge, but that normal people can play with. I mean, we have all the equipment. All you need is an iPod and a glass.
That actually does smooth it out. Mm-hmm. Interesting. It definitely smooths it out.
Quite a bit. And then try the cap. That for tannin?
Pretty big. Yeah, especially on the finish.
Okay, now I have a piece that's just a terrible piece for good red wines. It's really good with white
Zinfandel.
Okay. This is the Malorganite Ruse. It's about a guy whose Polish girlfriend bags up the human waste of the city of Milwaukee out on Jones Island. And it makes all great red wines just awful.
So do I taste all three again?
Oh, go this way.
Okay.
It won't take you very long. Yeah, just She's making a face. She's making a television face. I went up to
Milwaukee to see my baby there. She looked down at Jones Island. Her aroma was so rare. It seems the fertilizer is the
tantalizer that keeps me coming. This is the white Zinfandel.
It is the best one on the table. Definitely.
It's a bad table. So then, you know, for restaurants and wineries, what you really want is pieces that will make everything taste good that you make. And so so here's Adagio for strings. And that's a Winesmith anthem.
Okay.
So you'll see that both of these wines are wonderful. And even the Faux Chablis. You can stop drinking the whites in now.
Oh, okay.
That's not one of my wines.
Well, I do like the Faux Chablis. Pinot has less roughness, but still a bit bitter after finish. Definitely better with the cab. The cab no longer tastes awful.
Then finally, here's this is a Cabernet Franc that I made for two Jakes, and Dan Berger sent this down to Australia as one of the 100 best wines in the U.S.
Congratulations.
Which is something for a Cabernet Franc.
What year is it?
It's a 2010, Two Jakes. And it loves this piece of music.
It definitely loves the piece of music. Mm-hmm.
Now, an interesting thing about that wine is sort of the highest achievement of postmodern skill set is to be able to make wines that are sulfite-free. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not talking about health wine. I don't believe any of that stuff. The human body makes a gram a day. It's impossible to be allergic to sulfites. But sort of like an unpasteurized cheese, when you don't use the preservative and you have a good structure that will incorporate the microbiology, mm-hmm. you can really get some wonderful flavors, just like an Epoisse or, mm-hmm. you know, a Camembert or something. That you just get this extra expression in the wines that I think is very special.
It's been a very interesting experiment. We should prod the music down now because mm-hmm. you may be surprised to realize we are almost out of time. You enter a time warp when you come onto Mouthful. Time speeds up.
Too much fun.
I know that you have an event coming up.
I do. We're going to have a book release party on August 25th. And that's if you go to postmodernwinemaking.com, you can read all about it. It's at 515 Orchard Street and from 3 to 7.
What
and we're
town?
This is in Santa Rosa.
Okay.
It's at the church that I live in. I live in a 100-year-old church.
Oh, okay.
Right in the Cherry District. And
okay,
please don't park in the street. But you have to register to come. And mm-hmm. we're going to have Joel Peterson and Rick Jones. Joel from Ravenswood.
Oh, frequent guest on Mouthful.
Wonderful man.
Great storyteller.
The three of us are going to chat about all these things we've been talking about, mm-hmm. Minerality and structure and aromatic integration, soulful wines, and all of these concepts that are in the book. Mm-hmm. And I'll be signing books. You need to sign up. It's $50, but mm-hmm. you get a signed copy of the book, and you get to taste all these wines, and we'll be talking about all these concepts, and then have this two-hour panel discussion. Mm-hmm.
And it's August 25th. What time?
From 3 to 7.
3 to 7, and you go to postmodernwinemaking.com for the details, and I'll probably put something about this in my Mouthful column as well.
Oh, great.
So you can get that information there. The book, again, is Postmodern Winemaking. Who has published it?
It's UC Press.
UC Press.
What do you think?
You know, I think this has been a really, really fascinating hour. And to me, this is a winter book. This is curl up by the fire when nothing else is going on and geek out on details.
There you go.
You know, one thing I just want to, I have just a second here to plant this in your brain. When I was touring wineries in, I think it was when I was in South America. It might have been when I was in Spain. I have to go home and check my notes. But a winemaker there was talking about the shape. He was doing this barrel shaped a certain way based on Fibonacci principles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, based on the golden mean.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
I'm fascinated by Fibonacci. Is this anything that has crossed?
Do you subscribe to the Fibonacci Quarterly?
I don't, but I guess I will be.
Oh, you better.
So do you know anything about that, about constructing vessels based on the Fibonacci sequence?
I hadn't heard that one.
Okay, well then, there's your homework.
Okay.
Come back on Mouthful.
Wonderful.
And
okay,
on that note, we got a lot to clean up here in the studio. And I think, if I have it right, next week we are going to welcome back our friend Larry Carlin and Rabbi Stephanie Kramer, and maybe some other folks to talk about the upcoming Jewish food festival, which was such a huge success last year. So meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of The Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, Mouthful. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.
Children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.
Got some beans.